We gave you the Hugo award-winning episode, and we gave Alice an episode where a lizard man trips balls and they literally use a briefcase with little baggies. So we gave you two a little different flavor of what this season has to offer.
What does it say that I like Tess better?
You gotta check this out. Was our last best hope for podcasting. It failed. But in the wake of Babylon 5 haters everywhere, it became something greater. Our last best hope for sharing key episodes from a seminal 90s sci-fi show for victory. The year is 2025. The podcast, you gotta check this out.
Welcome to another episode of You Gotta Check This Out with Mike and Dre and another Mike. There's just too much to talk about. We are in the midst of Babylon 5 season 3, and we are getting into it in one of the best episodes, a Hugo Award-winning episode. So you've got myself, Dre Alvarez. We've got Mike Slater. And Mike, do you want to introduce our guest?
Yes. Today we have a special guest. You probably have heard of him through other podcasts. He does a lot of art around. This is Michael Vincent Bramley. Michael, can you introduce yourself to everybody?
Hi, guys. I think that did a good job of it. I do a lot of the podcast art that you've seen in your feeds, probably.
Oh, great. So what other art have you done besides podcasts? Because that's honestly, that is where I know you from. And then from a few things I followed you around on Instagram for.
Yeah, you will probably mostly know me from work I've done with Small Beans, Gainful Unemployed, 1-900 Hot Dog, so forth. I've done artwork for numerous art books, and I've made comics in the past, and I'm working on a comic right now. Can't speak much about it, but that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, understand. We won't ask you about that, but is there anything up top before we really get into the Babylon 5 talk that you'd like to plug to the audience?
Yeah, as for things to plug, you can find me at my website, mvbramley.art. That's the easiest way to contact me if you want to commission me for something.
And like I said, I will espouse, if you're watching this, the patreon.com/Jeff May feed, I'll try and make sure and include a link to it. You helped with a Christmas card that I commissioned last year, and you've done all sorts of commissions. I have one, if we can stay here for a little while, Mike number one, Mike Prime, we'll go for that.
I'm Mike Prime.
Mike Prime. I mean, clearly, Mike, you are the evil Mike because you do have the goatee. So we do have a Mike with the goatee and a Mike without, so.
You don't have a Mike without. Nobody calls me Mike. I won't allow it. So
if you just use Mike, like I'm the only one who's going to respond, Ray. So you're good there.
This is perfect, right? We definitely have a data lore situation, right? Because Michael doesn't do the abbreviation and Mike has the goatee. So we've got everything resolved.
I'm clearly evil on so many levels.
Yeah, you have clearly been corrupted by the space crystal or whatever is the case with lore, right? So we've got our data. We've got our lore. That works for me. But Mike and Michael, hope all of you can keep up. Now, let's get into the actual show, if that's all right. Babylon 5. Now, the thing we ask all of our guests is, how much interaction did you have with this show before we asked you on the pod? And how much did you watch since we started, since we sent you the assignment, so to speak?
I had never watched a full episode of Babylon 5 ever. In the 90s, I vaguely remember as they were coming out, sort of part of an episode where one of the characters went into some kind of cocoon or something and their alien prosthetics fell off.
Yes, we did that episode.
But it was, I didn't watch the whole thing. I just remember like vague scenes from it. I had no interaction with it until my wife and I were asked to do this podcast. And then I watched the episode that Alice covered with you guys. And then I watched the episode that you guys assigned me. So those are the only two episodes I've, to this day, ever seen of Babylon 5.
Previously on Babylon 5.
We only have three episodes since we last spoke on Babylon 5. We are in the middle of season 3, a lot going on. So the last episode we did with Alice was on Jakar tripping balls on alien psychic dust and discovering everything and having an epiphany about how to help with an upcoming war.
So the first of the three episodes since Dust is Dust was episode 7, Exogenesis. And I really enjoyed this one because you get Corwin got his time in the sun for this. Lieutenant Corwin, he is one of the lieutenants that's very close to command. And at this point of the series, Sheridan and the main command are trying to bring more of the lower commanders up into their circle. And a lot of it is trying to figure out if they can really trust Corwin, if he can be promoted up into and trusted. Really, the alliance they're forming to combat the fascist government that's taking over Earth. And then it's one of these sitcom-y tropes, though, where he misunderstands it all as Ivanova hitting on him. So it's like a lot of kind of dumb sitcom tropes on Babylon 5, where he is buying flowers, giving flowers to her, and she's, I don't know what these are for.
I love that you are focusing for the sci-fi show, focusing on that, because the A story, I think you just described the B story, Mike, is actually a really clever idea where it's a weird mix. I want to say it's like an homage to Blade Runner and Alien, because there is this alien creature that is a parasite that is getting implanted on people. It like attaches to their back and wraps around their spinal cord. And we think that they're evil and they're basically replicants. They're these old aliens that say they can't survive on their own. They have to be a symbiote to someone else. And they want to be the time, like the memory of the galaxy, and they're keeping a low profile because they're essentially a library. But it was interesting because it was very alien, right? Like body horror, person getting taken over by an alien. At one point, we think that they're evil. And then when they explain themselves, they do say, hey, we're replicants. They rip off that Ridley Scott line of the, I remember stars on Jupiter or whatever. One of them has that
well,
exact
the
same
The reason
thing.
I think all that stuck out to me so much is I remember that the alien stuff, but none of that really sticks around, and all the Corwin stuff kind of comes in later. Like every time, like they're given a look at each other later in the series, even if there's nothing in it, I'm like, oh, are they going back to the romance of that? But even later in that episode, that's the one where Marcus starts getting involved in Ivanova, which really comes into play later on in the series. So I'll give this one the Mike Slater romance episode a bump.
And then another recurring bit we have for Mike on the show is, and does it come up later? Nope. And I do love that. There are a number, for as much as JMS ties his universe together and lots of Chekhov's guns and plant and payoff, there are tons of premises that just come and go, but it also makes sense. They're like one-off arcs for almost Star Trek. Gene Roddenberry think pieces about an alien civilization.
Alien sci-fi stuff in this episode, no going back, no. But the romance.
So, previously on would have really helped with either of the episodes I watched, because I was completely in the dark. If they just give me a montage that explained all that stuff that you just said, that might have helped me get in.
Michael, there's a podcast out there that just exactly goes through the key episodes and takes you through all this stuff. All right, so then after that, the next episode is episode 8, Messages from Earth. In this one, we're really heating up the battles between Earth, and it's coming against Babylon 5, because the Clark government on Earth is starting to really realize that they're going to have to clamp down on Babylon 5. Sheridan's becoming more of a thorn in their side for just trying to go against what they're doing, because the Night Watch at this point has been going in trying to clamp down on any free thought within Babylon 5. Throughout this entire season, Sheridan has been pushing them back. We've seen Lieutenant Haircut go more and more into the Night Watch.
So on episode 8, Messages from Earth, what we discover is that Earth has been trying to tinker with the Shadow Vessel, and Babylon 5 is going to have to decide what to do. Episode 9, Point of No Return. President Clark, our fascist president, too on the nose, who has taken control of the media, who has inserted his own people in organizations that are allowed to say, hey, we're protecting the border, too on the nose, declares martial law on Babylon 5, and our people have to make a stand. Zach Allen, another haircut person, stands with Captain Sheridan, and as Mike noted, romantic haircut also stands with him. So all the side characters are taking a side. And one of the other key things we get, it actually does return, is we do have a Centauri prophet. I don't recall how much they show up in the episode you watched, Michael, but Centauri have the peacock hair, and their women can see the future. Some of their women can see the future. That's a plot that's introduced. And Londo Mollari discovers that he can't escape his fate. He will be emperor, and so will Veer. And it's played really funny, which is amusing because he is really another terrible character. But don't worry, we'll get back to him. And that brings us to now. Earth has declared martial law. Babylon 5 has to take a stand. Do they? We'll get to that, except what comes first?
Well, what comes first? Before we get into the actual episode, It's now time for the Talia Winters Memory Maze Quiz. Are you ready to be quizzed on the episode Severed Dreams of Babylon 5?
Jesus Christ. No.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go.
So the first category I call Babylon Drifters. Shake it. Question is, what were the name of the two Earth Force ships in conflict at the very beginning of this episode?
I want to say one of them was Cluxton.
Ding, ding, ding.
And the other one, I'm sorry. Am I allowed to swear on this?
I would, yeah, go for it. I would not want Mike as an English teacher. This is ridiculous, but nice.
It was something, Alexander?
You get, yeah.
What?
Okay. I didn't think I was going to get any of these.
And the Clarkston. Yeah. That is correct on both accounts. Question two. The category is nerd numbers. According to Sheridan's hologram, how many other colonies are inspired to resist martial law with Mars? And bonus points if you can name those colonies.
No, I can't. I'm afraid. No, that's good. I've got nothing. I'm going to say 10.
Orion 7 and Proxima 3.
Yep. Orion 7 and Proxima 3. That was exactly what I was going to say,
Excellent. Well, you got it right then. Yeah. All right. Question three. The category is missed connections. JMS cast Bruce McGill as Major Ryan by accidentally thinking he was what Twin Peaks actor with the same last name?
So, it's... The actor's name is McGill, and he's from Twin Peaks.
Can you name his first name?
I don't know his first name, but I do know the character he played. I'm not a big Twin Peaks fan. I think his name is Big Ed.
By the way, I am going to give full... we'll do the dock a point for missing the name, but give a point, bonus point, stealing from my taskmaster. He was named Big Ed on Twin Peaks, so you did get the... You got the David Lynch point, you missed the person's name, but that puts you up there with JMS, who was in the exact same boat, where he recognized him from Twin Peaks, didn't know his first
name. I just want to point out that your quiz here is a little bit unfair, because that wasn't in the episode. How am I meant to remember something and just...
The point of the quiz is it's supposed to be unfair. Okay. I mean, is any quiz really fair? Come on.
All right.
Anyway, all right. We'll go to multiple choice here to make it a little more fair for the last two guesses. Yeah. All right. So this category is Daddy Daycare. And what was the first lesson Sheridan's dad taught him? You have four choices.
I know already. You don't need to give me the multiple choices. It's never start a fight, but always end one. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, correct. Ding, 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 ding,
ding. I know this because it's the kind of advice that sounds good if you've never put it into practice. But my dad gave me the same advice when I was young. And I broke a kid's nose and got expelled from school.
So, excellent. Did he deserve it?
I mean, he did, but the school didn't see it that way.
They never do. All right, one last question. The category is rotten, no good, very bad things. Multiple choice again. In Sheridan's speech, he says that Clark violated the Constitution in three ways. Which of these is not one of the violations he mentioned? A, dissolving the Senate. B, declaring martial law. C, ordering the bombing of civilians. Or D, sexual assault with a concrete dildo. Which one of those did he not?
I think it's probably D.
Yes, D is actually one of the charges made against Frank Drebin in the first Naked Gun movie. So
I was okay. I'm glad that's at least a reference. I was like, where is your mind coming from, Mike?
I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but that got a lot darker than I remembered it.
All right, that's the end of the quiz. Dre, I think I can allow you to proceed on into the main meat of the episode.
Well, I want to know what I scored. Did I win?
Oh, yeah.
There is no winning in Mike's quiz. He is just a madman.
Michael, I will say that you are on the leaderboard, though.
Yeah, nice.
Yep. I think it's 25 points.
Sure. We'll mark it down. But yes, Mike is very much like Arcade. There's no winning. You got 25 points, but he's going to trap you in a giant thing in the future. We're about to get going on this episode. And of course, we'd be remiss not to mention this wins the Hugo, which is like a sci-fi award for like best, I believe, fiction. And it is a fan vote. This has the auspicious honor of being the first Hugo Award winning episode. to be won by Babylon 5 that we have covered, because last season I made the editor's decision to skip the Hugo Award-winning episode in favor of Two-Face, Bull Shannon from Night Court, being dressed up as Blade as an underling in the underworld of Babylon 5. I don't regret it, but we couldn't escape it this time with Severed Dreams, which did win the Hugo in part because there are some amazing special effects we are going to go over. And I do have to ask, because you're both amazing artists, so like, Michael, thoughts on that as a science fiction award for a piece of art?
So you have in the show notes here that it beat Star Trek First Contact, Independence Day, Mars Attacks, and DS9's Trials and Tribulations, right?
And, yeah, that's correct.
And I think that I've never been the biggest Deep Space Nine fan, but Trials and Tribulations is one of my favorite pieces of 90s Trek. And I revisit it all of the time, and I love that episode. And I find this criminal it beat that. Because I understand that there's like a checkered history between Babylon 5 and Deep Space Nine. But yeah, to me, coming in now and watching Babylon 5, it looks like the looks and feels and is acted like, and it seems like the asexual porn parody of Deep Space Nine.
This is the unfairness of it going. JMS, we've discussed this on the show, JMS came up with the idea for both, basically Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5. Deep Space Nine gets the budget.
Yeah.
Babylon 5 gets the original creator. And this has to hurt a lot of artists out there to go, if I give you my vision and you get 70% of my vision, but the full budget, and I get my full vision, but 10% of the budget, one's going to look better. Unless you're James Cameron on Aliens, and I don't understand how he did that movie for $18 million. Yeah, one looks better. So, I mean, I always sided with Babylon 5 versus Deep Space Nine in the feud, but I do think I would have to agree that Deep Space Nine had to have had better production quality. And one of the good bad parts of Babylon 5 is they were the first to embrace CGI, which probably looked very good for the era. But as Mike and I have noted now, it's the same level of quality of a StarCraft 2
cutscene. I was thinking it looked like a cutscene from Phantasy Star Online on the Dreamcast. Like every time.
Nice reference.
But it's kind of sad. Like, I completely 100% understand it. He got screwed here. But he still wound up making what seems like off-brand Trek next to again Deep Space Nine, which isn't even, I mean, it's like my least favorite like 90s Trek show. So, but it still feels more realized, I guess. And it's,
yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch Trials and Tribulations. I don't think I've ever seen that episode. I've only seen random episodes of Deep Space Nine here and there.
Same. But that particular episode, the producers will hate when people say it's their favorite Deep Space Nine episode, because it isn't really a Deep Space Nine episode. They take the cast of the show and they send them back in time to the original series. And you get to see the Deep Space Nine cast kind of
interact with the people.
They're trying to avoid interacting with Captain Kirk. So they're running around in the background of the original Tribbles episode, and it's the production on it. I mean, it looks incredible.
So it's like they Back to the Future too.
They do exactly
where at
that.
The end, it's like all of them are like watching them and trying not to interact with Marty.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely beautifully done. I think it holds up today. It's very funny, which the original Tribbles episode was
it's a classic
comedy episode of Trek. So yeah, I mean, I get that it's not saying anything heavier than, and yeah, let's all have fun, whereas this particular episode obviously has some weighty themes that
Well, I understand, because Mars Attacks on that list is my like personal favorite Burton movie. That one tickles me so much.
It is wild to put all of those on the same, because first off, Star Trek First Contact is one of my favorites. Also involves time travel. We got a lot of time travel in these categories. And Independence Day, that was special effects wise ridiculous. So it's odd. I don't want to say criminal. I want to avoid that, because I do think all of these things on this list are seminal pieces of science fiction. I haven't seen Trials and Tribulations, but the thing I can say to it is it's big enough that I have seen references to it, right? That's how I know. And I have seen all the others.
It's worth checking out whether you like Deep Space Nine or not. Yeah, it's just,
it can stand out.
Plus, it's got Worf in it. But it's, so you can just think of it as it's got Worf and O'Brien. So if you like TNG, you've got like point of reference
all together.
But it's just wild to have these all on the same list. It seems very much like you've got like a heavyweight boxer and a flyweight, and you're like, why are these all competing? It is something that Babylon 5 won that should speak to the state of mind in 1997. And I do think this was a remarkable episode. I guess I should ask that first, by the way. What did you think of this episode?
Oh, I hated it. But yeah.
Ooh, interesting.
I mean, I had to watch it and pause and walk around and come back. I'm sorry, guys.
No, we'll get to that. Let's get to that as we go scene by scene. I want to kind of hear these thoughts as we go. Yeah.
I will say this before we go on. It is remarkable that when you look at the pedigree in that Hugo category, I mean, if you look at all of these other things, that we've got blockbuster movies and Mars Attacks by an auteur director and First Contact, a big beloved Star Trek movie. One of the best episodes of 90s Trek and Independence Day. I mean, that's a true underdog story that something that people made for $20 won that award. this show with this weird science fiction episode of Days of Our Lives won that award. I mean, good for them.
This is exciting. I'm looking. Yeah. Okay. Let's let this unfold. That's enough. Let's get going. I'm excited.
Can we get to it?
So let's get to it.
Nice.
So we do get some fun here in the beginning, which I feel the big thing to mention, right, is JMS had started it big. He was the first person to try and do a 5-year-long arc for a show, and he had done that here. And so our first scene is actually building on that, because what we have is Narn, these lizard people, are now the security on Babylon 5. And that has happened because in the last episode, President Clark declared martial law, as we mentioned, and they had to get rid of a lot of security. Still has a very ACAP thing for me where they're like, good news, we got rid of the old security, we got new, harsher security, and isn't that great? And I was like, sure. But we have our new security. They're already kind of having an abuse of power because the lizard people, the Narn, had just lost a war with the Centauri, the peacock people. And one of the main Centauri comes to, that's Lana Malari, and he's insulting, he's being racist. And then he comes in and the Narn, oh man, the system's down, we can't get you in. Isn't it funny? And it is an interesting scene because, again, we've had some very weighty scenes about death and genocide and stuff with that war, but that's where we're at. Now we get into our civil war, which is the Alexander with Major Ryan is in a fight with the Clarkstown. And as we got in the quiz, the Alexander is an old Earthfleet ship. A lot of the old ships are named. It's a very common sci-fi trope, as you'll see in like Aliens, named after Greek, Roman, etc. mythology. And their name is always too on the nose for the plot, right? You have the Icarus gets too close to the sun, etc. Clarkstown is named for the new president. They're getting in a fight, and what I do want to revisit here is that ship is being held by Major Ryan because the actor that was supposed to be, who played General Haig, was double booked on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
So JMS had to replace him, and he
JMS getting revenge again against Deep Space Nine in any way he can on the show.
And he had intended to replace him with Everett McGill from Twin Peaks. And Everett McGill, right, is very stern, official looking. And I'm actually say, fortunately, the actor he gets, who is Bruce McGill, has a much different look. I mean, I think he politely in the director's commentary brings up that he's a little rotund. And I actually think that plays better because what we do get is he is clearly out of place and shouldn't be. Yeah. It's a very clerk scenario.
I would say
he's not even supposed to be
Bruce
there.
McGill seems more this series speed than Everett McGill.
Yeah.
And I think that he has this community theater approach to acting that really meshes well with the main cast whenever he's screaming.
Yeah, he's almost like a friendly guy. Oh, I just happen to be commander of this ship. How would I get here? Through this major battle as Mars is being bombarded.
Yeah. I'm trying to picture the intensity of Everett McGill.
Because this guy is, yeah, he does very much have to be like, why am I here? We still kind of have to keep going. Does have to seem trustworthy. So I think this is not the first time that JMS's first choice for ship captain had to be changed. And it's interesting how it turned up just better, in my opinion.
Yeah, it worked out for the episode, but it's like JMS will never miss an opportunity to kill somebody off screen who left Babylon 5 for DS9.
Or was a show note. That happened in season 2. He had a show note for a main character that he had to include in the credits, and he got mad and he killed him off at the end. Anyway, so they win the fight, and we do have like our commercial, like our cut to commercial obvious point where it's going, we're screwed. We only have one option left. We've got to go to Babylon 5 and we get our stinger. Dun, dun, dun. We do get Sheridan just recapping to the crew and the audience, us. Haig was the leader of the rebellion. He's going to come here. Everybody's going to hear about it. What are we going to do? We're going to have to start making decisions. They start jamming the signal and they're like, we're going to have to make a decision. He asks everybody, I will agree, this scene feels a little hokey and community theater. So what do we do? And they're like, fight. They all agree to fight.
Yeah, that was so, felt so staged when they all did the fight thing. There's no way they would all just like one at a time look at each other. Fight, and then pan over, fight.
Yeah. And we're like one guy who was like, actually.
I do. Well, we're going to get to that, actually. And JMS makes an explicit point about that exact point, but that's coming up in two scenes. Next scene, what we do get is we get a Mimbari to come in to say, hey, if you weren't paying attention to the Shadow War, it's still going on. And that's hey, where I got to see if I'm alone here.
Oh, go on.
I'll throw to Evil Mike. Mike. What did you think of the Mimbari's accent who showed up to tell them that the shadows were invading and the and everybody was scared?
It was just kind of soft-spoken about it. Like, I let it pass a little because it seemed like he was supposed to be injured and, like, almost was dying on the ship at all, but... I remember like not being I had to rewind that scene several times to even comprehend what was going on. Yeah, I don't remember his accent too much. It doesn't stick out at all.
It wasn't like an accent. It's just it was a weird acting choice. And yeah, the full thing is the Rangers are Earth and Mimbari like spy warriors. They're called Rangers. That is like a class in like D&D or Lord of the Rings. The one piece of world building we get is Jakar says, I can help get you by security, because those are all Narn. He's the leader of the lizard people. And he's trying to ingratiate himself into this inner circle that's fighting against the shadows. So that's the important world building. But we do get this like random day player who comes in to tell us about the status of the Shadow War. He's the dream of conquest. And I was like, this is a choice. And I didn't know. I was very curious how it landed to other people watching.
Yeah, for me, it just seemed like he was out of it and like about to slip out of consciousness. I didn't find that an accent choice so much as, oh, this guy is about to pass out.
I just want to point out that Jakar is the best actor in this show and has the best makeup.
Oh, easily. And, Andreas Katsoulis, one-armed man from The Fugitive, a great Harrison Ford movie, I point out.
I didn't realize that was who he was. But,
yep,
he reminds me of Alan Rickman in Galaxy Quest. That's all.
Yeah, yeah, he's acting through all the makeup and using it.
Yeah.
Like he always has a posture to him, and I'm not sure if it's just because of that makeup, how he has to stand, but he uses that in his performance, especially in this, where like when he has to carry that ranger in that very scene, he's like, I will carry him forever. And you can see him like slightly buckling under, this is a weighty guy, even for a muscular alien.
Yeah.
But he plays it well, like I will still carry him.
I keep getting hooked up on this guy whenever he's on screen, but it feels to me like, I don't know if you've ever seen like any amateur dramatics, like community theater or whatever. And sometimes mm-hmm. there's somebody who's like a big Shakespearean actor and they have a drinking problem, so they can't get any real work anymore. And they go and like, they do some community theater. This guy feels like that. Like he could have been Patrick Stewart or something, but he's slumming it.
I'll condense another couple of scenes that come together, but what we do get is shit's really starting to hit the fan because we cut to our news feed. ISN is the major network that kind of reports the news, and the very classic TV trope of whenever we need to hear important news, ISN will be reporting on it. The characters are watching. So ISN hops on and they start reporting on Mars getting bombed. I don't recall if it's this one, if not, consolidate things, but there is ISN saying, we haven't been allowed to tell you stuff and getting yanked. That might happen in this scene or later. But basically, Mars is getting bombed. The news admits it's compromised. And the Alexander, this renegade ship that's leading the rebellion against the president, is coming to Babylon 5. So everything's kind of hitting the head. And Sheridan goes into CNC, the command and control, and says, the Alexander's about to come. we're going to give support. We're not going to listen to illegal orders. And he does say, if anybody's not comfortable with it, you can leave. Now, romantic haircut sticks around. That's good. But people actually get up and leave. And JMS commented on the exact thing you just said on an earlier scene, Michael. When they're like, are we in or out? And everybody's like, in. And someone's like, I'm a year from good. I'm out. That actually does happen in the scene where some of the people on Command and Control do get up and walk out.
Yeah, I guess I kind of missed that.
It definitely came from Sheridan. It was good to see that in Sheridan's speech. There's some who are not going to stay to fight against some fascist evil, or they're going to want to get as far away as from this as they can as this is going on and heating up.
I'm frustrated. Michael, you have infected me on this episode because I came in. This is Hugo Award winning. This is amazing. How dare we give Dust to Alice and give you this episode? I think I'm going to side with you where I actually think Dust to Dust cohesively might hold together better. And I like it because we're about to get a very Game of Thrones season 6 or 7 thing coming up, because the Ranger who came in and kept us appraised of the Shadow War, Delenn's like, okay, so what, the Mimbari, the probably third or fourth most powerful race, what are we doing about this? What are we doing about this great evil? And he basically said, the Mimbari, the leader caste, which is called the Great Council, said, we're not going to get involved in the affairs of others. And Delenn's like, hell no. I'm going to go on a trek. I'm going to go to Membar this episode. And thinking about it logistically, jumping forward in the episode, her getting to Membar, doing what she does, and if she needed to make it back for some reason, is ridiculous in the time frame we are given.
Trek amongst stars deep into space, nines even, right?
I earned that. But we get Major Ryan on board, as I mentioned. Bruce McGill, I do think, just is perfect. He's not supposed to be there. This is like inadvertently good casting because he looks like a general that he is a little overweight. Reminds me a lot of Battlestar Galactica with Edward James Olmos, where he's retired. I'm just here for ceremony. And suddenly they're like, now you're in charge of everything. And this is the same position. He's like, yeah, I'm leading the resistance. What am I doing here? But he kind of catches us up saying, here's how Clark has taken over. Here's how bad stuff has gotten.
They're sending a warship to Babylon 5 right away to take over command of Babylon 5 and put the entire command under arrest at this point. And this is where they get the Alfred Hitchcock rack mount shot of Sheridan as they tell him what's going on. He's realizing that, oh, they are coming to take us all down.
Babylon 5 is standing up to Clark and they're going to be getting taken over. And there's another ship, the Churchill, who is also defected. It's heading to Babylon 5.
And it's a big misdirect, too, because the whole time they're talking, they assume that, oh, we are going to be court-martialed just for taking the ship under, just for taking Haig's ship. And then what she reveals to them as she gets there is, no, they were already on their way to take over Babylon 5. There's nothing you could have done. Even if you wouldn't have given the ship sanctuary, Clark was already on his way to take over Babylon 5.
And what we also get there, a little intermediate scene is, yeah, Delenn's going back right on this trek that does not work logistically now that I've thought about it out loud. Thank you,
Michael. What kind of trek was it?
Star Trek, yeah. But Jakar runs into her and basically says, I helped you out, I want in, we're joining forces, Jakar wants to join with. Okay, already mentioned, as mentioned, everything's hit the fan. ISN, media is compromised. 3 ships are at Babylon 5. Delenn's going to be doing something. And what are we going to do? We do now have the Churchill arrive as well. So the Churchill, the Alexander, Babylon 5 are going. We're going to have to fight. They're getting ready. And guess what? As I mentioned, Jakar with the Narn gave him some security. The Narn are ready to fight too. Michael, this next scene is interesting. So we do get Delenn. She meets up with the Grey Council. The Grey Council are the leader of the Mimbari, who are the most powerful non-god race in the show. They're 2 god races. And she goes in to basically shame them into fighting, saying, we've been told the shadows are coming. They're evil. They're the worst. You're all too cowardly to fight. She splits the Grey Council. She does the same thing. She's, we're going to fight and leave. She walks out. She breaks the staff that's the command thing. People leave with her. How'd that scene play?
Not great.
Correct.
The Grey Council, is it? The Grey Council? The
Grey Council, yeah.
It looked like a frat initiation.
Yeah. Damn it, Michael. That's
on the nose.
I couldn't help but feel like they all got their robes from getting spanked with that like thing that she broke, the stuff, or playing Jizz Biscuit or something. Like, it was like it looked so cheap and for something that was meant to be such a big deal. And
this
actress who plays
Delenn, yeah.
She looks like she's on the verge of cracking up because she can see everything around her. She can see all of the costumes and things and the sets, and she's, oh yeah, this is fucking hilarious. And I'm doing
this doesn't make it better, because I'm like, hey, not that, but what legitimately happens is that staff was not rigged correctly. There's a famous moment in wrestling, a Shockmaster. This guy was supposed to be a big reveal, and they didn't make the wall correctly. So he's supposed to come through the wall, and he can't break through the wall, and he trips over a 2x4 because it should have been a rigged wall, but instead it's a real wall, so he can't break through. He takes too long, he falls over, his helmet falls off, and it's live. And they're like, she was supposed to break that staff, and if you're going to do that as an effect, that staff needs to be prepped to break. It wasn't
so prepped.
Take after take, she couldn't break it. And so they finally get it up, and she's able to break it, and she's happy when she breaks it. So you're right.
I caught it in the notes, the frame where you can see her smile or smirking as she's breaking it, when it's supposed to be this like show of force, and she's, I broke it.
She looks pleased with herself almost.
Yeah, that was her fourth or fifth take doing this very serious moment, and you're right.
By the way,
she's smiling.
I actually, I was watching this scene, and I had to look her up, because she looked very familiar to me. And up until this point, I assumed that if I remembered or recognized any of these people, it was like from 30-year-old headshots that they were selling at conventions to scrape by a living. But she was in Lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She was a crazy French lady, right? In Lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rousseau.
Okay. Right, good for her.
Yeah, this whole scene bothered me for a different reason, because I've now, like, I just finished up season 4 of Babylon 5. I'm staying kind of just ahead of where everything is here. And I know that all those council members that are kind of sitting around there, they are characters who would not stay silent for a moment. Those are like members of the warrior cast that later on go into a civil war with each other.
So for all of the talk of Straczynski's long-form storytelling and planning,
mm-hmm.
clearly hadn't decided yet that these guys had personalities. So.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Otherwise, he would have had one of them say something.
Actually, this gets even rougher.
One of them has already been a character.
Yeah, that's Narun. Narun has been established and is awesome, and we do know he would be there. This falls on a thing. I actually discussed it in the most recent episode of Nerd that, again, will be in the past for you listening to this episode, talking aliens and saying, when I watch shows and I get overly nitpicky and then I have to kind of pull myself back and say, oh, does it play for effect? I can't even hold up my finger and be like, wait. So, yeah, Narun hates Delenn. We've seen that in show. Hopefully we cover this episode. There is an upcoming episode where him and Delenn get into it, and he talks a lot. So
yeah, he would have grabbed that staff right from her. He would not have let her smash that thing, not let alone 10 tries.
So I'm going to do what Dre usually does here and do the show's work for it. Like, wait, this is your thing, right, Dre? So I think that none of them are talking because they just had a rager at the frat house the night before.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all lost their voices from shouting over the music and drinking too much over the
By with what I could also buy, this would make a lot of sense for the Great Council, right? Is they all wear the robes with the hoods. And you could easily use that as an excuse to be like, I can't go in today to send my assistant. And no one wants to reveal. So like,
none
of the Great Council is there. They were at a rager and they all sent in their assistants. Yeah. And they're like, crap, what do we do? She's leaving. Let's just leave.
I like how you're buying into the idea that the Grey Council did throw a rager because they are a frat house. There's nothing
no way they would
the evidence.
But yeah, so the next scene, we have an established actor. We have Rance Howard, who is Ron and Clint Howard's dad. And the scene is Sheridan calls his dad to be like, hey, dad, just catching up, and mom around, y'all doing good. And it's a very sweet scene. He even says, I'm on an open channel. So we get some back and forth. We do get kind of the ham-fisted as dad. What did I always tell you about fighting, which may apply to an upcoming thing? And he goes, never start a fight, but always finish it. And if you do, break the guy's nose and get kicked out of school.
Yeah.
I remember, dad. So it's like a sweet scene, but I would say that Bruce Boxleitner and Rance Howard are both like established actors just doing a conversation with a lot of subtext to it. So I thought that scene, the next scene plays well.
That was very good.
Which is Sheridan calling his dad to basically say goodbye before he has to commit mutiny. So we do get a funny moment, which is, Michael, you're going to enjoy this. Babylon 5 is right over a planet that actually has a giant supercomputer with a bunch of history that can also look through time and record it. I'm not making this up. Is run by like a human or Mimbari host and also has a lot of really powerful missiles. That is in lore. They do make a good job of saying, hey, we're not going to use that because that's our ace in the hole, which is incidentally forgotten later in the episode. But he says, we're not going to use it for that. But it also does have a holographic telegraphic machine. So Sheridan has his body all over the station doing a hologram of him talking, saying, we're going to break free from Earth. We're going to fight against President Clark. We got to do this. So we have all of our people coming together. So we do have Ivanova goes with the space troopers. Garibaldi is going to go with the ground crew. A point JMS brings up in the director's commentary, which I do think is cool, is I do think a lot of thought is given to space warfare, which is cool, right? To compare to Star Trek, this is a place where Babylon can win. Star Trek, right, you usually just have two models and they're firing photon torpedoes or blasters at each other.
It looks Babylon, better than this.
Yeah. Well, okay, so that, but yeah, I mean, it's hard. Like I said, especially with dated CGI, I think that is a death knell. And I've been mentioning that as I've been as I rewatched Alien and Aliens, and I've been a sci-fi fan. I am well aware that the kiss of death is for anything that says it has great CGI. All you have to do is go come back in 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is groundbreaking now. Everybody says it's amazing now. We're going to come back in 10 years. And there's a reason, right? Jurassic Park's going to hold up. And Independence Day, as we brought up, right? Independence Day literally like lit ornate full-scale models that were like 1/80th the size or something, right? And just blew them up. That's why it looks amazing. Yeah. So much CGI effect from the 90s.
Even today, I think it's hard to beat those practical effects in
oh, yeah.
I think if you... Even when they're a little hokey, they have a charm to them that CGI just doesn't have, and they have a weight to them. Yeah, so yeah.
It's like going back and watching just like the Jim Henson puppet stuff versus CGI stuff today. Going back, rewatching like Dark Crystal and Labyrinth, there's just a charm to that type of sci-fi that doesn't, or even Lord of the Rings just has so much of that like puppetry stuff in there that like melded with the CG in great ways. Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park kind of broke the world for this, because there was a myth at the time that it was all CG. Most of Jurassic Park was practical effects.
Yeah, there's just little bits to shine the edges, yeah.
Yeah, some CG, and it actually still looks great today, but the most dated shots are all the CG ones. Like, all the practical effects still look fantastic. But it created this myth that you could do anything with CG.
Oh, well, even more than that, like the Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I think is the biggest example of that. That was the first time where they used CG color to recolor grading. Everything. Uh-huh. And for there, it was done for very purposeful, and it works really well. Yeah. And then everybody took the wrong lesson from this. Yeah, oh, so we can do that forever? Yeah.
10 or 15 years, everything was blue and orange. Mm-hmm. People yeah. were bright orange against blue backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, tell me if this sounds familiar. You've got automation that people think is going to make everything cheaper, and it makes it all worse and throws a bunch of people out of work.
Alice and I watched the Pirates of the Caribbean movies a couple of years mm-hmm. ago. And the second and third movie look incredible. They were mm-hmm. using the kind of CGI there were a lot of CGI effects, but it kind of peaked around then, which I guess would have been around 2006 or 7. And most of what we see now is trashy and worse for some reason.
Yeah, like the whole MCU thing where everything has to end in just a big hole, CGI in the sky with too much shit flying everywhere.
Yeah, and weightless looking CGI yeah. puppets of monsters punching other monsters.
Yeah. Well, going back to this though, I mean, to bring it back to Babylon 5, yeah, the CGI may have been looked crappy, but I think the thought was behind it, all the ships. One of my favorite elements of it is all these giant Earth ships. They don't have the technology for gravity yet in all of these. So all the Earth destroyers, they have to have those giant wells that are turning, and those all mean something, but they don't really bring that to the front. You've got to really kind of see that in the background. Oh, that's why they're designed that way. Mm. Same with the Shadows versus the Vorlons, where all the Shadow ships are made after crustaceans, and the Vorlon ships are designed after mollusks.
And yeah, I feel like this is maybe something that like stands out more to a viewer who has seen the whole series and can pick
Yeah, like
apart that
us.
context. But to the uninitiated, again, just
Yeah.
Phantasy Star Online on the Sega Dreamcast,
Yeah, it goes into like how much does that design work come across too? Sometimes like you have artists and craft artists who are working so little on one little piece of a door somewhere on a set that will never be noticed, but all of those little decisions come together can eventually build something bigger. It's just difficult to see at first glance sometimes, and sometimes it never comes across, but the work is there.
these CGI fights were interspersed with gunfights on
It,
Babylon 5, right?
they were doing that. One thing that I need to bug Mike on, because this
Oh?
doesn't come up enough, is like I brought up Christopher Frank and the music, and I do think the music on Babylon 5 is great. I think, and I mean, I say, so I'm actually curious to ask the musician about this. Because something that they do during this fight, right, is they literally turn the volume down and we have interspersed fights. We have the Star Furies and the big ships fighting outside. We have the Narn trying to block the incoming raiding party. And so, yeah, as they mentioned, they basically have a ship that can attach the side of Babylon 5 and breach the hull, but keep it sealed because if they breached it, it would just be a problem. And have a bunch of people come in. They even mention kind of aliens that they would have come up through the floor. And that's actually the issue is Garibaldi, our chief of security, knows what to wait for, but the Narn do not. So the Narn just kind of run in and we just get a lot of death and mayhem. And as that's going, we just have the Babylon 5 Christopher Frank soundtrack playing. It's a variant of the song. It happens at the Battle of the Line. Of the things in this big firefight, as we're mentioning, fighting in the air, fighting on the ground, the music, the operatic music, it's one of the most. The reason it likely won the Hugo, according to JMS, is this was one of the most cuts, largest special effects for a TV show. I still struggle because I do remember Independence Day that summer.
My notes for the episode here, just that the gunfights in this episode make Captain Kirk look like John Wick. We can move
Yeah, it's hard to defend a lot. I mean, we even said that on the, remember, Mike, the episode with Bull Shannon, right, with Richard
We're
Mole,
talking about like
where.
they can't really fire on a ship. They're going to go through the hull a lot of times, right?
It's in the director's commentary, JMS does say it is ignited helium. So that's why it doesn't breach the hull and that's why it like cauterizes wounds and that's why it's still effective. But the bigger problem is it's CGI after the fact. And so it is hard to get actors to respond properly to it, especially since it's put in after the fact. And they give these PPG blasts like really large sound. Right. You're right. As we're watching these fights go on and after the fact, we're seeing the shots get added in. It's rough, but a lot's going on. I missed this too, by the way, Mike. This is your fault now. So we got other mics. So Michael one ruined things. Mike number two is going to ruin things more. One of the ships is going to go down, and they have a guest Japanese actress on the show, and she dies by kamikazeing her ship.
Jesus.
Yeah, that is another part that just did not sit well. But anyway, yeah, that's the end of the battle. They end up taking out the one big ship who's coming by to put the shock troops, all the Night Watch on B5 and take over. They're getting this sigh of relief where, all right, the battle's over. We got rid of it. We can sit here and lick our wounds. And what happens then, Dre?
Now, this is, I, again, I'm going to just be really curious to see how this aged, but it is one of the most fun scenes. So it's over, right? All of our actors and actresses inexplicably are bleeding by somehow, right? Because it's a space station, but fine. There was enough collateral damage that it happened, right? Lieutenant Haircut says, we couldn't have taken much more. And then immediately, a bunch of Earth vessels jump in.
Yeah, so
And
now
it's
they've
like,
gotten through that huge battle with one, depleted all their resources, and now they have to do it four times as much as what they just did.
here's what makes it rough to me is this episode itself has us say, should we use Epsilon 3? No, that's our ace in the hole. So when this comes up, this episode has actually primed us to be like, okay, hey, now's the time to use Epsilon 3, which you reminded us we have. But
Sorry, Epsilon 3 is that thing you were talking about, like that giant weapon that they have in the planet. Is that it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
So they're basically sitting on a Death Star and then not using it.
yeah.
Okay. All right. Just
That they go out of their way to mention in this. So if you're a nerd like us, you remember they literally say, "Hey, could we use Epsilon 3's weapons?" And they go, "No, we're not going to use their weapons unless we really need to." So they have this climactic moment at the end where
not desperate enough yet.
they're like, "Oh my God, we're out of chances." But then also to make matters worse, we hear four jump points forming on top of us. It's, "Oh, we're screwed. We're even more screwed." But Delenn is back with three Minbari like flagships as well as the White Star, which is the ship we've been using all season. And she basically comes in and just says, "Babylon 5 is under Minbari control. Leave now." And it's a good bit of back and forth because they're like, "Babylon 5's under our control." And she's like, "Nope, it's under our control." And they go, "You're wrong." And she goes, "Only one Earth captain has survived combat. He's behind me. You're in front of me. If you value your lives, be someplace else." And they leave. I will, for though this is an audio medium, but Michael is like covering his face. This scene does play in universe, but I want to hear your comments here.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I mean, again, this is, I keep saying this, but this is, I'm sure, something that felt very powerful for people who are invested in the show, but it feels very hard to take seriously as somebody who's jumped in for this episode. So, yeah, I don't really have much else to say on it. Yeah.
I mean, what I do love, right, as a defense, is the one defense going is this is the argument behind like story building and why trying to just go for individual big moments, right, like spectacle in special effects, I kind of rally against because it's going the way that scenes are memorable is context and build. And we threw you into the middle of this, right? You don't have two seasons of backstory where we found out the Minbari are super powerful and huge and that there's this argument where people like Captain Sheridan have been telling people, "Look, the Minbari kicked our asses. Anybody that thinks that we should be like going to war with them is absurd," versus like this sentiment, this like Jango-esque sentiment back home on Earth in the show. We're like, "Ah, we could take the Minbari," right? So we've got these builds happening that even then we see it happen. Earth has been saying, "We could have won the Earth Minbari war. We don't need the Minbari." And then when they show up with their ships, they're like, "Ah, we're out." So like that plays. There is actually a little point to saying, if we plop you into the middle of the episode and say you've got to check this out, you're giving validity to the fact that Babylon 5 is a serial, probably has some weight, but there's a lot of stuff individually that makes it harder to eat.
I guess one of my issues here as well, and this isn't, I can't really blame Babylon 5 for this. My issue, I guess, is that it's more with sci-fi in general that is speculated on fascist uprisings and as opposed to just Babylon 5. But when Delenn shows up at the end to save the day, it's a convenient solution. But I think it's possibly, I mean, looking at what they had as a frame of reference, like that's the Americans showing up in the Second World War. So the only solution we have on record for dealing with fascism, I guess, is pretty much just get a bigger, technologically superior friend to help you solve the problem.
What they Sheridan keeps pushing for the rest of the series is that that is not the solution.
Okay, that's good. Okay.
What Babylon 5 is about, he wins the war eventually by finding defectors, and they
Right.
slowly they don't let themselves fire on Earth ships. Instead, they have to use spies and usual subterfuge means and direct talking to people all together to try and figure out how to convince them that it's wrong what Clark is doing. And they don't use that superior force until like they have enough defectors from Earth who come out and they can just have a common like, "No, this is what should happen instead." So they do kind of go that way, but as far as this episode, yeah, Michael, you're right on. This is they're just taking a deus ex machina with the
Yeah.
next biggest thing, and that's how they solve it.
That's okay. Yeah. That makes me feel a bit better about it. Again, I'm watching this in a vacuum and it isn't
Yes.
designed to be watched that way. And I understand
And this podcast is designed to get that opinion from someone who watches it in a vacuum.
And like I said, even for me,
Right.
right? I'm going to compare this to George R. R. Martin and myself, right? I would be disingenuous to be the person that was bashing HBO and the people that put on the showrunners for Game of Thrones for just speeding it too much. I would be disingenuous to have that complaint to then not have one of the award-winning episodes of Babylon 5 and not note, hey, this episode plays because Delenn is able to leave in the middle of a battle, run home to the, like, the ruling class of her government, convince them to give her four major ships, which they hate doing, rush all the way back and show up just in time to lay it down a major line and be like, that is incredibly convenient. And the emotions it hit, the emotional arcs are great, but I'd be lying if I'm like, hey, I bashed this in Game of Thrones. I like this from my childhood. It's the exact same issue. And
Dre, you're many things, but a hypocrite you are not.
Oh, I'm easily a hypocrite. That's fine.
Yeah, but, you're a hypocrite too. What am I saying?
You got to call me on a podcast, then I got no choice, right? All right. Now we do get kind of the nice wind down. They do give some nice explanation, like, hey, you can take the fighters from the kamikaze ship, which will be useful to explain why Babylon 5 has newer fighters for future plot lines. Give some credit there for world building and, right, like a director and showrunner thinking about the future. Sheridan says, hey, I'm not going to put on my uniform for a while because he's going against Earth. They're sending out the Night Watch folk. Garibaldi's explaining, hey, stuff's going to be hard for a while. We do have a pretty nerdy scene where Delenn comes in and Sheridan's, ah, you're cool. And he kisses her hand.
Kisses her
and everybody's
hand.
Laughing at him. It's supposed to be awkward as the defense. So it is. That scene plays.
Does he start wearing a fedora instead of his jacket? I'm just curious about the future of this.
Oh my gosh. He's going to start wearing Garibaldi's fedora. Amazing unintentional callback, Michael.
Yep. Garibaldi is a fedora guy.
And then we do end the episode with them saying, Sheridan, come here. And everybody on the station applauds him. And Mike put this in the notes, which I appreciate. JMS even agreed. He's like, yeah, it's probably in the show note, but he wanted to give his hero like the applause
at the end, even how cheesy it is for him to come out and just, yeah, let's give him his cheers and end it like that.
This show is so weirdly chaste and sexless. It reminds me of that Black Mirror episode, the USS Callister. I think they're all smooth down there. I don't think that
they're all Barbie and Ken. Yeah, that's why he's got to go for the hand.
There's even when they try to hint at romance, there's something about it that feels.
It's just juvenile. Like they.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so what? Yeah, I have to call it out throughout the entire series. There's times when they call it like woohoo time, and there's another episode where the whole thing is with whether Sheridan and Delenn are going to have sex in this sex ritual, and then he's all excited, and then they go into the bed and oh no, and all this Mimbari religious class has to watch us perform this.
That I loved that episode, and I'll have comments on it, which is hilarious.
I don't think like DS9 like really fucked or anything, but it felt like it at least had the birds and the bees conversation with its parents in a way.
They have like kids and stuff running around in the episode, and I do love that in Star Trek that like Worf is a bad dad, which I actually do love as kind of just a running Star Trek thing, and they don't quite shy away from it. Alexander's always like, "You're not a good dad," and he's like, "So yeah."
I know this is highly irregular.
Yeah, that brings us to the end of the episode. So, Michael, do you have one nice big thought that you can wrap up your feelings of Babylon 5 after Severed Dreams?
No.
Yeah, expect.
I mean, fuck no. I guess my big thought, right, is, if I have anything, is this helped me understand why people made fun of me when I was a kid for liking Star Trek. And it made me rethink a lot of things. And I've decided I had to really sit with this and consider it. And I've decided I'm going to become a jock now. And I spoke to Jeff, actually, got him to sign off on this. But he says I can bully you. So I'm going to do that. And I'm going to need you to tell me what you spent on your lunch today. And I'm going to send you a Venmo request for your lunch money.
Oh, my God. Modern day is going to have Venmo bullies. I don't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah, I don't, this hurts me more than it hurts you, but I think that I'm helping you.
Yeah, we're the underdogs now.
Yeah, and I told Alice about this, and she's lovely, so she begged me not to, but I have to do it. So next time I see you, Mike, at Thanksgiving, and I'm looking forward to it. It's always lovely to hang out. I'm going to have to give you a wedgie, and I'm going to size you up for any lockers that we pass by, because I want to see if you fit in there.
I'll be sure to bring some lunch to throw somewhere to maybe throw you off somewhere so I can scurry away somehow. I think that's how I always did it before.
You inadvertently did make a couple of Iron Man 3 references, the drunk Shakespearean actor.
Oh, that shit, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, but it is interesting where that movie also has one of the origin story of the villain gets slighted and that's why this happens, right? And so this is like the lamest origin story. It's like, man, when did NVB go evil, right? You become WVB like Wario. And it's like Mike and Dre made him watch an episode of Babylon 5 and it broke
the origin story right there.
That's actually, you were saying at the beginning that Mike Slater here was the evil one, but it turns out I was the evil.
Oh no, we didn't see it coming.
I actually have a little something as well. There's going to be a pause, but I'm going to send you a link and I want you to check this out because I don't know if you've ever seen it. And maybe this has come up before, but I send it to the email chain. Now, this is from the British TV series Spaced by Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright.
Good series.
Excellent series. And this is the one reference in the show to Babylon 5. Where Simon Pegg Tim is trying to get fired from his job. I'd like you to play it in the episode.
Derek, Babylon 5's a big pile of shit. Get out! Yay!
The weird crystallizing thing for me that I really want to hold to, and it makes a lot of sense, is Babylon 5, it's almost a fractal. Because you're saying Babylon 5 next to Star Trek looks worse. And it's hard to argue that, right? And then you're even saying you zoom into Babylon 5 and Babylon 5 in itself compared to itself, the Narn as an example compared to the Centauri looks bad. And then even in this episode, right, you zoom into this episode and you have this scene of can't crack a thing with the frat party. Yeah, and like what's going on next to established actors doing like good monologues. So it is very fascinating to realize that, to say that if you are contrasting the show with all of the context in episode, in series, in the oeuvre at the time, it just is very jarring. And I could totally buy, like I said, projecting onto the artist, you just being like, everything clashes in this and I can't enjoy it. And I'm like, yeah, I can actually understand that.
Yeah, I toyed with just pretending I was more into it than I was, but I thought that you guys deserved my honesty on this.
Exactly. That's what we want.
But I genuinely appreciate you having me on and giving me the opportunity to fill in at least a little bit of my pop culture blind spot here.
This was great. This is kind of exactly what we expected for actually more of our guests coming on. So thanks for filling in that role. Is there anything else that you want to plug or you think our listeners should check out?
I give you some recommendations for your listeners. If you're a fan of Straczynski, I think there's a bit of a hidden gem. Rising Stars, a comic book that he did in the 90s. I haven't revisited it in a long time, but I remember it told a complete story in a self-contained format, and I remember quite liking it. It was a very high concept as far as superhero books go. And it's also, I think, probably very much of its time. It's one of those things you're not going to see. It has that, like, early 2000s aversion to costumes and capes and whatnot. So it's more of a down-to-earth take. I think he might have sued Heroes, the TV show, over similarities.
There's a lot of different plots. It's almost like the whole white event thing that Marvel kept doing, where just like random people just get superpowers for different reasons out and then following them along. So it's been done before a few times. But yeah, it's Rising Stars, a great take on that.
Rising Stars is good, and or at least I remember it being good. It's worth checking out if you're a fan of Babylon 5, I think. Then also, if I squint like very fucking closely at this show, I see some similarities in the stuff that I think you like, that you've been talking about today, that I think people like about it, with the work of Brian K. Vaughan. He's written a few comic books that I would recommend. Saga is the obvious one because it's a space opera set during sort of an intergalactic war. But honestly, two of his more like Earth-based comic books, I think, would appeal to fans of this series, and that's Why the Last Man and Ex Machina, which is not related to the movie Ex Machina. It's a different thing.
Mm-hmm. They politician both... who has the mech suit, right?
That's he was a.
Oh no, that's his power. I read that at the time. It's been a while.
Ex Machina is honestly, I also think that's kind of underrated as far as Brian K. Vaughan's work goes. It's about a New York mayor who gained some abilities through a weird science fiction accident. And he attempted and arguably failed to be a superhero. So instead he became the mayor of New York. And it reads almost like the West Wing, but there's this running through line of eerie science fiction. And it's not really a superhero book, but it borrows a little of the iconography, and the character himself is a superhero fan. But the reason I think it might appeal to fans of Babylon 5 is there's a big emphasis on politics in this science fiction world, and seeing how these scenarios play out in a world where that stuff is,
Yeah, that was an early, I don't know if early, but that was like an early 2000s Vertigo book too. And that's the time when I was reading just like everything that Vertigo came out, if I remember. Was it Vertigo?
no, it was, I believe it was Wildstorm, but I think it was rebranded as Vertigo. I don't know, but
Yeah.
it was in that realm. It was definitely, if you liked Vertigo stuff, that would be a book that you would pick up. Brian K. Vaughan's other book that I mentioned, Why the Last Man, that was a Vertigo book.
That
And
might be what
that's
I'm thinking of, because I was re-picking up both of those. Those are a publisher right about the same time, too.
yeah, they were running concurrently. And they're both long-running but self-contained books, tell a complete story, and they both stick the landing, in my opinion. So, like, that's again what I keep hearing about Babylon 5. Long-running science fiction
Well,
sticks
sticking
on.
the landing is going to be an interesting one, but that will be it for future. So, yeah, we'll say we have kept you late, which is awesome. I'll say about Brian K. Vaughan, much like JMS, he has two Hugo Awards. I just looked him up. So
And also wrote for Lost.
if you love
He
the
did.
Hugo Award-winning JMS, you'll love Brian K. Vaughan. Love it. Michael, thank you so much for being on. Evil Mike, I think, or maybe not. I'm not even sure anymore. My reality is turned upside down. Thanks as always. We have Slatron as well as MikeSlater.com. MV Bramley, BRAMLEY.art. That name is also on Instagram. A lot of great art there. You can find me most places as Nerd Numbers. Hope you keep watching Babylon 5 or not, because we will keep finding people that haven't seen it and make them watch it. That is our directive.
Next episode, we are going to be covering season 3, episodes 16 and 17, War Without End, parts 1 and 2, with a very special guest, Carl Wolf, who's actually the person who got me into Babylon 5 when it was first on.
Though it'll be hilarious if he comes on and says, "Actually, I don't like him." I'm like, "I don't know what's going on." Anyway, thanks everybody for watching.
Thanks for having me.